Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And signs of growing age. Most of my friends don't see me with spectacles on, so there's nothing like a pleasant surprise. Makes us all feel very comfortable, very neat, very mortal. Now, on this occasion of our celebration of the tricentenary of Swedenborg's birth, an enormous number of things could be said about the very laudable and remarkable qualities of this man. Now, it is not my duty to speak along these lines, but rather to indicate some more unusual aspects of the impact of his work upon the world. But there are three things that I think we should bear in connection with our tricentenary celebration. It marks the entry into this world of one of the most remarkable, industrious, and creative minds of history. And through this man, there was further introduced into the world a very clear and most inspiring image of higher life, of the nature of the spiritual world, and above all, a tremendous number of details concerning the nature of the divine. And the third thing is, the writings of Swedenborg are beginning to have an enormous impact upon human society. If we try to bear these three things in mind, then we'll see Swedenborg in a perspective that I believe that he would enjoy, that he would approve of. Swedenborg was, as you all know, a very outstanding scientist. He wrote a large number of works on physical science, and as a result of this, he became acknowledged in the world as an honest, sincere, truthful observer, experimenter, and recorder of data. This reliability, honesty, and integrity of the man stood forth and was acknowledged, and as a result, none of Swedenborg's opinions could be lightly dismissed. People may disagree, they may argue with him, but there was a fundamental honesty and integrity in the man, and the accuracy with which he observed and recorded his observations became a characteristic of his life. This was to bear him in good stead when his spiritual senses were finally opened. One of the most remarkable things that Swedenborg has presented to the world is a very clear picture of the nature of spiritual life. I think most people on the face of this earth would dearly love to know what it's like in the spiritual world. Is life going to be a matter of sitting on a jet-propelled cloud? Is it a matter of playing amplified-type harps? Is it going to be just one big jam session? Or is it going to be a matter of the eternal praising of God with hallelujahs? Swedenborg presented a most sane, stable, acceptable, and understandable picture of the spiritual world. And his imagery, which we'll return to in a moment, stands in very sharp contrasts with some of the great standard works about the spiritual world which lasted throughout history. For example, the ancient Egyptians had a work called Imi Duat, what is in the Duat, or what is in the underworld. And filled with hieroglyphs, with paintings and drawings, this remarkable book purported to show the fate of those who had lived either useful lives or very evil kinds of lives. And in all the remarkable pictures that we see, there are images of torture and punishment. There are instances of prayers, but we do not see the occupations of the people who are living in the Egyptian spiritual world. It was a generalized image. And if we go over to the Bardo Todol, or the Tibetan Book of the Dead, written thousands of years later, here we have one of those classics of spiritual life in which the numerous levels of the after-death state are described and set forth in very great detail, insofar as colours, energies, the images of gods and goddesses and various symbols are described. And the idea is that when a person passes out of the body at death, one goes to the highest level. But if there is no sufficient development of the soul to keep one at the highest level, you sink down a little. And the Baro Todol describes how one is given an opportunity at every level to try and find a point of consolidation, to become part and parcel of that level. For some, the sinking continues until certain souls find themselves reincarnated back in a body and they have to start the whole climb again. Now, in these ancient and classical descriptions of the spiritual world, we do not get any image whatsoever of what life is like in that world. And this is where Swedenborg's picture is so remarkable. His vision of the way in which people live in the post-mortem state is highly detailed. He describes the occupations of people who are in the spiritual world. He describes their studies, their discourses, the environment. Some people of evil disposition find themselves living in dark caves or seemingly in swamps. Those of a scholarly disposition find themselves in all sorts of libraries and places where they can continue their research. He gives a very, very detailed, homely and acceptable picture of ongoing life. And this is where he shines over and above the ancient classical descriptions of the spiritual world in very general terms. This alone is a major contribution which must surely bring comfort, confidence and certainty in the lives of very large numbers of people in the world. Now, as a thinker, Swedenborg, as we mentioned earlier, was an accurate and intelligent, honest man. His reputation for honest scientific work went before him. When his spiritual senses were opened, he approached the observation of spiritual matters and experiences with the same intelligent, cool objectivity that he had employed in his scientific observations and discoveries. And he set down in copious notes, which he cross-referenced with very great detail, the experiences that he had. And out of these myriads of experiences, which spread over more than a quarter of a century, his theological writings gradually emerged to give an incredible picture, a multi-level picture of a universe quite beyond the dreams and imaginations of the theologians of the time and of a good many philosophers of the time. It is the meticulous manner in which he has described and reported his experiences, the honesty and integrity of the man himself, which when we read his Arcana Celestia and his other works, and he describes in a direct and straightforward manner what he has seen in spiritual realms, we are touched by the honesty, by the directness. There is no effort to cover up any inadequacy. There is no attempt to paint over and make things appear to be different. He describes simply what he sees, and it is in this honest approach that we feel that Swedenborg has a great deal to offer us. Emanuel Swedenborg bequeathed to the world a type of universal religion. At first, this may not seem obvious, but when we study all the different aspects of spirituality that he presents, we find that his writings have a message and they have a method for all people of all denominations. His reach into the greatest celestial heights and his descent into incredible infernal depths gives him a range of the perception of spirituality which is nothing short of astonishing. He spans the whole range of possible human experience, and that is the range of religion. Either people have a great religious impulse or a superficial one, or a simple passing one, almost childlike in its operations, or the negation of one. Whatever a person's attitude is, it is an attitude towards religion, even if it's denying religion. The very person who denies God has some sort of concept of God in the mind in the first place, to try and resist and deny the idea. So what Swedenborg is presenting is an enormous cosmic image of something we can relate to. Now remember, the very word religion itself speaks of relationship. It is a re-ligating of ourselves with the source. Religion is a living thing, not a theoretical substitute for actual living. It is a process in which we must participate. No person can be fully alive and search for meaning without being religious in himself or herself. This is a basic law. So whether we care to call it by the name of religion or some other name, that doesn't matter. Our relationship with the infinite creative source is the all-important thing that determines our religion for us. Now Swedenborg pointed out in this universal religious image that he developed that the universe is layered. It is composed of discontinuous layers. These layers are composed of various cosmic substances. He describes the divine, which is sufficient unto itself, but the divine emanates its own substance, and with progressive condensations, differentiations and separations from the divine, there is established, first of all, a universal celestial world, which is different from the divine, yet is capable of receiving divine energies. And then comes yet another condensation, if you like, a lowering of vibratory activity, so that another vast, vast world, the spiritual world, is formed with its own spiritual substances. And so this process continues down to the natural level, this physical world in which we live. Now these levels are discontinuous. They don't merge one into the other. So this very idea of discontinuity which Swedenborg presents is most interesting. It was a foreshadowing on a cosmic scale of a great insight and development in this, the 20th century, in the form of quantum physics. Scientists in this century have learned to discover that universal energies at the atomic level are arranged in discontinuous layers, discontinuous levels, where the energies are different and the properties and behavior of electrons are different. So on the small scale that science is now looking at and examining so closely, Swedenborg saw the whole outline on a cosmic as well as a microcosmic pattern. It is this foreshadowing of things to come that we find in many of Swedenborg's writings that is really the theme that we are talking about. He saw in principle many things that were not even feasible in his own day, or were not understood or not acceptable. But in later ages, such as this present 20th century, the things that he wrote about and spoke of are becoming manifest, they're being demonstrated, they're being proven. There is a time jump from Swedenborg's perception of these things in a spiritual way to their actual perception and realization in both a psychological and a physical way in this age. And this is the theme that we're looking at, because these time jumps are connected with eternity in an interesting way that we'll look at quite soon. Now, in modern scientific evolution theory, the view is taken that we human beings are not very different from the rest of the animal kingdom. Indeed, evolution theory tends to regard that we human beings have just been spawned from the general biological process of random gene selection and natural selection to become existing beings, that we have no privileged place, we have no specialized function, and there is no special meaning for our being here. That's rather a dismal view. Swedenborg, by contrast, insists that we are meaningful, insists that we are purposeful creations and productions in this universe, who are not only necessary for spiritual purposes, but we fulfill cosmic and natural processes and purposes. Swedenborg is very strong on this. He is against the idea that human life, mind and spirit simply emerge out of matter. Now, in his writings, he begins to present fascinating correlations between the bodily part of our being, our psychology, and the spiritual foundations of our existence. When we start examining these correlations and correspondences, we enter an exciting world which has many modern discoveries to support the things that he said. Now, when Swedenborg was writing his spiritual diary, he set forth some principles that to us are extremely fascinating. He tells us that there is no such thing as thought or feeling in the abstract. Thoughts and feelings, he tells us, are associated with, to use his own words, organic substances. And he goes on to stress, in the Divine Providence and other writings, that it's absolutely impossible for any internal, meaningful process to occur in our spirits or our minds without there being a correlated and closely associated manifestation of changes in organic substances. He even went on to describe memory as a permanent change in the organic substances which normally keep on fluctuating with our thoughts and feelings. He was the first man to really pinpoint and describe the neurons in the brain, which he described as star-like formations which send fibers down through the spinal cord and into the body. And in his marvelous studies in the brain, he anticipated neurological research by centuries. But his description of these organic substances is something that is very intriguing, because in his day there was no systematic organic chemistry, no physiological chemistry, no knowledge whatsoever of neurotransmitters or hormones. Nobody knew even the nature of proteins and carbohydrates properly. So he's talking about changes in substances, the formation of memory as the laying down of substances in a permanent form. His position was so far ahead of his time that his contemporaries couldn't understand what he was talking about. And indeed, once again, it's only in this 20th century that we can fully appreciate and completely verify what Swedenborg was saying. Here was another one of his time jumps, his inner vision of different substances, spiritual substances, psychological substances, organic substances in the body, all associated with our feelings and thoughts, our drives and aspirations and memories, has now been verified very, very completely with the discovery of neurotransmitters such as acetylcholine, serotonin, dopamine, adrenaline, noradrenaline. These are substances that modern-day biochemists know in their fluctuations and variations are connected with mood changes, changes in our ability to concentrate. And it's also known that alterations in pH and the acidity of our internal tissues has very, very considerable effects upon our psychological behaviour. And it's most interesting that only a few years ago Swedish scientists, and how relevant this is, Swedish scientists were able to demonstrate that when permanent long-term memories are formed, there is an actual laying down in nerve tissue of new protein substance which becomes built in. The very thing that Swedenborg said so accurately more than 200 years ago, that fluctuations of state are responsible for thoughts and feelings, but when there is the establishment of memory, permanent substances are laid down. That is a wonderful time jump, and it's this idea of
Swedenborg's perceptions not being fully manifest in the state of science in his day, but becoming viable a little later in time. The seeds are sown in his own time, the fruits become visible a little later. And that is quite an astonishing process. One of the things that he keeps on stressing that is rather strange to many people of a pious disposition is that all things are substantial and God is substance. Various people throughout the world seem to think that God is mental image, a vapor, a gas, an energy wave, an indefinite energy field. All sorts of remarkable notions are formulated by people as they try to come to grips with the idea of God. But here again is Swedenborg, the accurate reporter, telling us that God is substance, the substance from which all other substances are separated and condensed. The idea of God being substantial means that here is a reality that in some internal way we can get hold of. The idea of the disciples touching the body of the risen Christ is a representation of this.
Now, it's true, the divine substance is so utterly beyond our physical touch, our sensory perception, that we cannot directly know it. But there are a lot of things in the natural world that are like this. We don't feel cosmic rays going through our body. We don't feel radio waves going through our body. There are many types of wavelengths and emanations of which we are completely insensitive to. We just don't feel them. And because our physical senses cannot detect the emanations and radiations and the substantiality of the divine, doesn't mean to say that it's unreal. Because there is a correlation between inner and outer parts of us. Swedenborg never tired of telling us that we have a body, we have a mind, and that we have a soul. This inmost soul receives life and energy from God. And he indicates that the soul has these spiritual passions and these spiritual senses. Just as our physical senses can perceive and discern the things of the physical world, so our soul senses can discern in their own way things and realities that to our physical senses don't seem substantial at all. It is a matter of learning to shift the center of gravity from our sense-based life to our mind-based life to our soul-based life. And that is the human prerogative. Swedenborg keeps telling people in his writings, by making inner efforts, we can lift ourselves from a lower outer level to more interior, more internal levels. This is our duty in the universe. This is our responsibility to ourselves. And if one thing that Swedenborg would have us accept is our own spiritual responsibility. We are responsible for what we make of ourselves. And if we receive from the divine the gift of every grade of energy, of every atom of information, of every kind of data, of every kind of inspiration, of every grade of affection and feeling, if we receive these without ending and with total abundance, there is something wrong with us if we cannot accept even a fraction of these things and build them in an orderly, intelligent way into our lives. This is where Swedenborg shines. He wants us to become eminently practical people, not mere theoretical theologians, not merely pious people who feel all comfy and holy when they're singing hymns and reading the Bible and going through the prayer book, but people who with great courage and fortitude can reach out and interact with everything the divine is communicating. Active interaction with the divine is the way to live. It is the only way that we can develop our inner selves. To be merely a passive being is to be an incomplete being. Again, in Swedenborg's writings, he tells us that the person who remains passive, with the arms hanging down, expecting all these wondrous things to come from God, is grievously mistaken. Because conjunction can only be established when there is an action from the divine and a reaction or a response from the human. If something makes affirmations and makes energetic drives through us to raise us up, to enrich us, we must respond and react in like kind where possible. Then a conjunction can be established. But Swedenborg makes it very, very clear. If the divine acts and a person remains utterly passive, then it's as though the passive recedes, dissolves away, so that the active has got nothing to act upon. It just acts and it moves away from the person, and all is lost. Now, this is a recommendation from a man who knew through direct experience what it's like to feel the divine influx, what it is like to be a visitor and an observer in the spiritual world, what it is to go through thousands of different psychological and spiritual states, to know the whole spectrum of human suffering and human joy. Here was a man who was eminently practical in his spiritual experiences. We must do likewise. To grow and develop, we must become effective strivers after that which inwardly we believe and understand to be useful, effective, good, and true. Those are the discriminating factors that we must decide upon, and that's why we have this great intelligent brain that is the instrument through which our mind can work its wonders. And it is a wonder that we can look at various things and evaluate them and understand them. We take so many things for granted as just daily activities. We don't stop to pause and wonder about the way we think. What is a thought? What is a feeling? How do we live? To become more fully alive, we must try to sense the experience of life each day. We must try to feel this flow of life through us as an intimate experience which is given to us directly from above. When we try to pinpoint just where our life is, we can't do it. Sometimes we feel that our life is concentrated in the head, other times in the chest, around the heart, other times maybe in the legs. But to try and pinpoint life itself is virtually impossible. But we should try to do so, because unless we try, we'll never come to an understanding of our limits and the unlimited nature of the divine energy that flows into us. So here is a simple practical plea. Each day, try to sense the flow of life in yourself. Try to understand its operations. Try to see where it comes from. Try to see what it is doing for you. Earlier, Professor Smart made reference to Swedenborg's Journal of Dreams. This is a topic that is so very important because it illustrates another one of the time jumps that come from Swedenborg's visions. When Swedenborg began to investigate his own dreams, he did so in a most empirical way. He wrote his dreams down, he puzzled over them, and he tried to analyze them so that he could figure out a meaning and a message. He knew from Bible studies that dreams had always been significant and important to mankind, but more in the sense of their being the conductors of prophetic and revelatory materials. But as he studied his dreams more closely, he began to discern that there was an operational wisdom acting through those dreams. Sometimes the dreams, or that wisdom in the dreams, chided him. At other times it inspired him, and at other times it gently corrected where he was going wrong in his thoughts and his feelings and his ambitions. Dr. Van Dusen, a very prominent and able American psychologist, has rendered a sterling service to mankind by writing an extensive commentary to Swedenborg's Journal of Dreams, which is very, very readable. And he points out, that is Dr. Van Dusen, he points out that a careful study of Swedenborg's life before and after the writing of the Journal of Dreams shows an astonishing change. The quality of Swedenborg's writings before the dreaming period began were scientific, interesting, but in themselves lifeless and a little dull at times, although fascinating facts were recorded. But after the construction of the Journal of Dreams, something had changed inside Swedenborg. His writings became filled with life. There was a deep feeling. There was an interest in the reader's concern for things. There was a personal reaching out and a touching of the inner life of the reader. Something new had been born inside Swedenborg. And it's this quality of change that comes about through Swedenborg's own work with his dreams that are so crucial. Now, Swedenborg's Journal of Dreams was a first in history. Nobody else had recorded a systematic series of dreams and had written analytical comments, as had Swedenborg. Here he paved the way for what was to come. It wasn't until the beginning of this century that Sigmund Freud and his early colleague Carl Jung began to examine dreams much more deeply, isolating symbols, finding inner significations, and they were pioneers in the modern psychological movement. Since their time, there have now been established dream laboratories in several parts of the world where scientists, using sophisticated electronic equipment, measure the duration, the cyclicity, and the psychophysiology of dreams. An enormous amount is known about dreaming. But it was Swedenborg who started the whole thing, and in that sense, he was the herald of a new era. Even if it was confined just to dream psychology, he was the initiator, the founder, of a whole new way of exploring the human psyche. Swedenborg never tired of trying to inspire people into fresh insights into the living word of God. Swedenborg saw that the divine word, as he called it, was a living process, not something just written down that was merely the record of ancient legends and myths, but he saw it as something which touches every person if only the inner content can be disclosed. Again, Professor Smart touched on this quite neatly in his address this morning, where he spoke about the correspondences, the correspondential nature of the word is such that it relates to many levels in us, the sensory level, our intellectual level, our emotional level, and our spiritual level, and it relates to the same corresponding levels that we spoke about earlier in the universe, the celestial, the spiritual, and the natural. It's this point-to-point correspondence. The meaning that is shown in outer things can only be understood in terms of the values and qualities that stand behind the object and the symbol in the spiritual world. This was a huge principle, and Swedenborg made many explanations of how the process of correspondence works. One has to read through the whole of the Arcana Celestia to really capture the idea of correspondences. It carries many shades of meaning. The idea of correspondences is not just a simple symbolism. It is something much deeper than that. The difficulty is this: the divine, which is quite beyond anything that we can personally understand, even though it has personal relationship to us, communicates itself and its wisdom and its love to everything in the universe in the best way that is possible. For we human beings, because our languages are so different, because our gestural signs differ from one tribe and nation to another, The one universal language in which the divine communicates itself to us is through correspondences. Correspondences are the spiritual symbolic language of divine communication, and also it is the natural language of our inner spiritual being. Notice that it is the natural language of our inner spirit. It's something that we seem to enter into when we leave this planet after physical death. Once we get over the initial adaptations to the spiritual world, we gradually come into a realization of the universality of these living spiritual symbols. Now, when Swedenborg began to write about correspondences, very, very few people in his day grasped and understood what he was referring to. And indeed, outside Swedenborg's writings, incredibly little was known about correspondences, how they functioned, and what their purposes were. And therefore, it was quite astonishing when, in 1931, there appeared in the English language a book called A New Model of the Universe by a certain P.D. Uspensky. Uspensky had studied with a strange traveller in the East, a certain G.I. Gurdjieff, who tramped around the Orient in search of spiritual wisdom, especially the wisdom of forgotten aspects of Christianity. And Gurdjieff brought back to the Western world some very remarkable knowledge, which in some respects ties up very, very closely with Swedenborg, and which we'll return to in a few minutes, and we'll discuss this. But Uspensky himself, after being associated with Gurdjieff for a number of years, began to polish up some of the earlier essays he had written. And in this book, A New Model of the Universe, one of the early chapters is called Esotericism and Modern Thought. And Uspensky has this to say. Now, let's just try to find the actual reference. He begins to talk about creation as the work of a great laboratory. Now, this is just a figurative way of speaking. We mustn't be too harsh on Uspensky for writing in this manner. Remember, he is a profound thinker. He had been subject to spiritual disciplines. He was a man who believed in trying to raise human beings to the highest possible level of consciousness. So he writes and thinks with a purpose. So he talks about creation as though it is the work of a great cosmic laboratory. And his words are, all the work of the great laboratory had in view one aim, the creation of man. This idea in itself is totally harmonious with what Swedenborg had written 200 years earlier. Listen to what Swedenborg says. Man is the principal end of creation. All things were created for his sake. Everything has been created for man as its end. This is an astonishing overlapping of ideas. It is the same idea being represented a little later in a different form through a different mind. But what Swedenborg saw so dramatically and clearly, that man is the principal end of creation, Uspensky suddenly grasped this. The idea came to him almost from nowhere. Well, of course, it rises up or enters one from a greater source. There is no doubt about that. But it entered Uspensky in such a graphic way that he summarized many of the things that Swedenborg said without having any knowledge of Swedenborg's teachings at all. It now becomes quite interesting. Uspensky continues to write, everything in the laboratory began to work long before man appeared. A multitude of forms were created, and each form, in order to be alive, included in itself and expressed some of the fundamental cosmic laws appearing as their symbol or hieroglyph. This is astonishing, because here we have, in a nutshell, the principle of correspondences. That's what Uspensky hit upon. And I stress, without any knowledge of Swedenborg's writings at all, here we have two things reappearing. Here is a time jump from Swedenborg's writings to open declarations in the 20th century. A declaration that man is the end of creation, the principal thing in creation, and that everything that exists is the outer embodiment and hieroglyph or representation of all the internal energies and laws and processes that go into its making. Just listen to what Swedenborg has to say on this thing. The spiritual things to which natural things correspond present themselves in the natural under a different appearance so as not to be recognized. These are amazing non-coincidences, because they're not coincidences in time, they're coincidences in eternity. These time jumps come from, I believe, an eternal source. We shall also look at this aspect of the eternal in a few minutes. But first, another important theme from Swedenborg, which shows up in modern esoteric psychology in the 20th century. I'm sorry that all my notes are mixed up and I'm not accustomed to using notes. Swedenborg stressed that man is asleep. He quotes the ancients and says that the ancients often referred to as ordinary human beings being in a state of deep sleep. He goes on to describe how people, if they are not connecting themselves with their spiritual function, are inwardly dead to and asleep to their spiritual possibilities, and are only mechanical alive in the external sensory part of themselves. Swedenborg describes a psychological sleep in which people seem to move about with their eyes open, but they're looking at fantasies and dreams and have all sorts of hazy states within themselves. Now, he writes about this quite extensively, and in a number of his works, The True Christian Religion, Divine Providence, Divine Love and Wisdom, these statements are repeated, and there are several references in the Arcana Celestia, that man is in a sleeping state. Now, this is not a terribly flattering thought. It may hurt us a little, but nevertheless, the principle is true if we observe ourselves. Daydreams do occupy a great deal of our thought and a great deal of our time and energy. Swedenborg stresses that if we're going to be spiritually complete, we must wake up. But how to awaken ourselves out of sleep? He gave plenty of practical formulas. He indicated that we must take the initiative. He indicated that we have to be the actively responsive participant in cooperating with God's drives and affirmations which are reaching us constantly. He calls forth so much of the practical in us. But in Swedenborg's day, and even for some time afterwards, this idea that man is in a sleeping state didn't affect many people at all. They sort of glossed over the words. Oh, well, yes, that applies to the rest of them out there. Can't possibly apply to me. And this is how we are. We project our own faults away and hang them upon other people where we can see them very clearly, and we never inspect ourselves. How to awaken from sleep. This is where things get interesting, because it's another time jump. Swedenborg wanted people to wake up. He referred to the fact that throughout the word, throughout the Bible, especially in the New Testament, there are lots and lots and lots of references to being asleep and to waking up. Even the disciples fell asleep when he was struggling in the Garden of Gethsemane. You see, all these things are relevant. They relate to this inner sleep of mankind. And Swedenborg wanted people to snap out of this sleep. So it's exciting and refreshing to find that at the turn of the century, especially around about the time of World War I, Gurdjieff, who had been tramping through Asia looking for ancient knowledge, had encountered forgotten aspects of esoteric Christianity and had found centers of spiritual instruction for which he had acquired a number of methods, turned up in the West and began teaching practical methods of inner development. And one of the things that he stressed so repeatedly was the idea that man is in mechanical sleep and must awaken from sleep before he can even begin to develop his potentials. P.D. Uspensky, that we mentioned a little earlier, became enthralled with this idea of struggling against sleep, and he joined forces with Gurdjieff. And together these men, over a period of many years, collected around them competent, intelligent disciples who themselves carried on this same work of awakening from sleep. Such men as Professor Kenneth Walker, Professor of Surgery at the Royal College of Surgeons, Dr. Morris Nickel, prominent Harley Street psychiatrist, Frank Lloyd Wright the architect, so we could go on. Really intelligent people gathered around because they could see how important it was to snap out of this sleep state. So what Swedenborg saw over 200 years ago as a necessary thing for mankind to come out of this state of daydream and fantasy, to face oneself, to see oneself squarely, to face the real world and to see all the possibilities that stand before us. And yet few people took notice. It seemed that a time jump was necessary so that through other mouths, through other minds, through other writings, precisely the same thing that the divine would have known to people comes forth with dramatic intensity and has stirred and awakened and helped a very large number of people, even in this present generation. It's seeing how the ideas of Swedenborg have swept forward and have become functional expressions. When we study many of his writings in this respect, we can draw from Swedenborg as a center a series of circles of increasing radius. And with each wave front or each circle, we can see in different ages new aspects, further aspects of what Swedenborg originally wrote about, slowly being developed, slowly being brought forward, sometimes being dramatically manifested. This incredible repetition in time of what Swedenborg saw, taught, and wrote about so clearly and prolifically, and which crops up at a later age, the same theme, the same drive, the same message. This is an hypocrisical recurrence whereby a potentiality is rendered into a reality. Hyparxis is an ancient Greek word which means coming into one's own possessions. It also is a process of transforming our potentialities into actualities. And what applies to the individual applies to the human race. We very often have to repeatedly go over many, many things in our lives to make them stick in our lives and become permanent and established. And likewise in mankind, the hard lessons of spiritual wisdom often have to be gone over cyclically and with great repetition before even the simplest lesson is driven home. The human race, by and large, is a slow learner with fundamental principles. But it's only by cyclic repetition, by this hypoxic process, which is an extension through time, that these important principles become clearly established for us and for mankind. Now, we said that there is a relationship to eternity that our time jumps can be understood in the light of. Let me put it this way. In eternity, there is no time. Swedenborg stressed this so very clearly. Both space and time, he declared, came into existence with creation. Prior to that, there was no time. Eternity is that which is without time. It's an eternal now. It is an ever-living state of nowness. No time intervals at all. Swedenborg further points out that when souls eventually become celestial, they enter into a state that is quite eternal. And he gives very fine descriptions in the Arcana Celestia of this celestial state, because he says of these celestial souls that having this oneness with eternity, the past is a complete and total experience for them, The future is a complete and total intuitive experience for them, because both past and future are the living realities in their present. Elsewhere, he points out that in eternity, past, present and future are all one. They are continuously alive in their own way. It's very difficult for us to comprehend this. If we had a motor accident 6 months ago, we don't want that accident to keep on repeating itself forever. If we had a sickness 10 years ago, we don't want that illness to keep on repeating itself indefinitely. You see, we think in a sensory way. We think in a space-time way about these things. Eternity is not space-time thinking. Since the eternal, not being in time and not being in space, is the infinite, since it is the source of all potentiality, then whatever has existed and functioned in the past, whatever is operating now, whatever can possibly manifest and unfold in the future, is here now in eternity, in either potential or fully developed form. What we see as time jumps from now to future is only an illusion of the senses of our understanding. It's an expression of our limitation. From the eternal itself, that which is already unfolding and manifesting in the future already is. Now, we're not trying to become philosophical. Try to grasp this as a direct inner state, as a direct inner experience, and it can be understood. We can get this feeling of eternity now. All of us are the servants of time. We are bound up too much in space and time. Perhaps this is why, in biblical phraseology, we have to overcome the world. We have to see that the world is, in a certain sense, a snare. It's only a snare insofar as we remain psychologically asleep and don't see how we relate to outer things and to inner things. There is a relationship that we can participate in, that we can feel. And it's this entry into a more holistic picture and imagery of reality that is important to our growth. Just think of everything that Swedenborg wrote in his theological writings, over 30 very extensive volumes, and the range of subjects that he covers in those theological writings are astonishing. He weaves together the energies and properties and qualities of the divine. He talks about the celestial states of love and sharing and communication. He talks about the spiritual, he talks about the natural, and to illustrate these things he draws upon anatomy and physiology, examples from mineralogy and chemistry and from physical science and astronomy. He gives us a very, very huge holistic picture of reality woven together with a oneness that is quite striking and inspiring. That holistic picture was, again, not appreciated by his contemporaries. Swedenborg was too broad, too inclusive for many of the minds around him, although they were clever, specialized minds. Again, it's only in this present century, more or less in our own contemporary age, that the idea of holism is coming forth once again, particularly in the field of alternative medicine. The idea of holistic healing, of approaching the whole person, the spirit as well as the mind, the body, the chemistry, the environment, the nutrition, the exercise, all of these things in a person are approached from a total viewpoint. Again, this is a time jump from Swedenborg's cosmic holism to our own approaches to holism. The spirit of holism is raising itself up again, and with our modern science, with our modern insights, with our modern understanding and appreciation of the interaction of things, of ecological interconnections, we can begin to appreciate the value of the holistic approach. And when we go back to Swedenborg and really review his holistic principles, we are astonished to see how vast and how inclusive they were. How's our time going? Right. We have to watch this very carefully. Swedenborg, taken by and large, is a man that we must look at so profoundly, not because he was just a clever man. Swedenborg himself, in his early years, had a great deal of self-pride. He was very proud of his attainments. He went through a number of experiences that gradually knocked that out of him. And this was part of the humbling process, which can do us all good if we can be big enough and wise enough to take the process into ourselves. Swedenborg regarded himself as the instrument for something which came from the Lord God, and for him only that counted. For him, all healing, all wisdom, all truth, all renewal, all regeneration was the gift of the divine. This psycho-spiritual system communicated by Swedenborg had for its author none other than the Lord God, the divine. This being so, then it means that within Swedenborg's writings we have perhaps the most complete, the most reliable, the soundest and the most helpful psycho-spiritual system of transformation that we can ever get hold of. For that reason alone, it's worth studying Swedenborg in depth. Swedenborg gives us a practical psycho-spiritual approach. It is summarized so well in the True Christian Religion, expounded in detail and in depth in the Arcana Celestia. Swedenborg has given us an enormous amount of material which he claims comes from the highest creative source. If we're interested, if we're touched by these ideas, if we even have an inkling towards growing a better understanding and a better self inside ourselves, we cannot ignore Swedenborg. Remember, from Swedenborg's viewpoint, we are the future of his age. He was writing for the future. He was making a time jump even as he wrote, because he could see and recorded that when he put all these materials down, that at the beginning only a few would begin to accept and appreciate the ideas. Gradually more would assimilate the ideas, until eventually there would be a universal acceptance. And that is what he called the coming into existence of this new church, because after all, every individual who receives into himself the living dynamics of the living God is a church. So to the extent that we are an integrating church within ourselves, so we're able to grow. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.